Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we're talking to people employed in fields potentially imperiled by the results of the recent U.S. presidential election. These are the stories of passionate individuals doing difficult, hugely important jobs, jobs that make it a lot harder and a lot more important in the years ahead. For this episode, we visited Masjid Muhammad, one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest mosques. We spoke there with Imam Talib Sharif, who retired from the U.S. Air Force as a chief master sergeant and who helped reform the military's relationship with its Muslim service members during his own time with the armed forces. Imam Sharif spoke with us about some of his basic responsibilities as a religious leader, such as leading prayers, and about his involvement with interfaith projects, along with other forms of community outreach. And he addressed the ways that Islamophobia informs his daily efforts, before, during, and after the rise of Donald Trump. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Imam Sharif discusses his decades-long study of martial arts and explains how it plays into his more peaceful work at the mosque. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives via Slate Plus. Start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus.
What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Talib Sharif. I am the president and the imam of the nation's mosque, Masjid Muhammad, which is an 80-year community.
So what do you do here as president and imam?
Oh, wow. So that's quite a bit. Yeah, obviously, both titles means two hats. So you have the imam side, which mainly accounts for a lot of religious classes, teaching, lectures, counseling. And then you have the president's side, which deals with infrastructure stuff for the corporate piece of the organization.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to Islam, how you converted?
Yes. I'm going to be a little sensitive, but I'm going to give you some personal stuff real quick. I was born in New York. My father was killed violently. And so my mother got us out. I was maybe four. And we moved to North Carolina, which is that's where I actually grew up as a child. In North Carolina, my mother remarried. And this husband, eventually, he was not a good husband. Domestic violence. And I was young, 5, 6 years old. So anyway, he was going to hurt her real bad one day. And she managed to get me and my sister at the time out of the home and went to her mother's home. So he apparently followed her, and he was surveilling her mother's home where she was in. And I guess he saw her from outside where she was at, and he could have shot her. He had a rifle. But he decided, he wanted to be dramatic and get up close, so he crashed through the window. The noise got everybody's attention, so I came out in the hallway, just a young guy. He comes to the window crashing, has a rifle. He's getting ready to shoot my mother, my uncle, and this is a teenager at the time. Maybe he was 16, maybe 15, 16. My uncle, without hesitation, reservation, he just went right to him and grabbed a gun right in the nick of time. When my mother got shot in the leg, it was lying the way she was standing on her heart, but he got it down where it shot her in the leg. And then my uncle, some instinctive thinking, he just pulled back and grabbed a chair and hit him with a chair, and he fled after that. Now, I wanted to bring this uncle in because this is what happened and caused me. I was not a Muslim then. Nobody was a Muslim at that time in the family. We were Christians. But I became endeared to him. I love this. He saved my mother's life. And when you're a child, you look for models. That's why we talk about mentoring and big brothers, those kind of things, and sisters, because you're looking for models. You look for the best examples. So I started everything this guy was doing. He was really something, So he ended up going into the military. He left, went into the military. He was into martial arts. He was my first teacher. I'm a martial art master now. And he was in the Vietnam War. But like many, when they came back from Vietnam, and he saw a lot. He was with a lot of his actual friends he grew up with and everything, and he lost a lot of them, and he saw them killed in very horrific ways, you know. And of course, you know, he has PTSD today. He's still with us today. But he came back, and because like most of them, you don't get to process that stuff there. And you come back and that stuff is operating, and then you come into an environment where you're not treated well. Now, we know that Vietnam, most Vietnam veterans, regardless of your race or ethnicity, whatever, you weren't treated well. So people were angry. He was one of the ones that got angry, and he began to join groups in society, the Black Panther type group. And he had joined the group, this group, the foundation of this community was the Nation of Islam, but we are universal now. And I loved it, I went with him. I went with him everywhere, so I joined too. With him. This is the movement that Muhammad Ali was a part of. Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, we know his story when it came to the military. So that movement discredited anyone that was a part of it from serving in the military. Violence was something that was not welcome. Anyway, so his service, my uncle's service in the military, I told you what he witnessed, what he went through, his sacrifice. He's a Purple Heart. Most of them got Purple Hearts. He's wounded. He's got Agent Orange. He got all kinds of problems he got right now from that war. All that was discredited. The sacrifice that he made was discredited.
Because they wouldn't acknowledge.
They wouldn't get support for it, wouldn't get acknowledgement for it. So eventually, this is what happened. The leader of the movement that was Muhammad Ali's leader changed to the son of that leader, Wallace Muhammad. He became a leader in the 70s. And he was also in prison for graft evasion, that kind of thing, because they wouldn't let him. Father told him not to take the conscience objector. But this is the key. He did something that nobody in America was doing. And even when it was not popular, he picked up the American flag. Despite what had happened in the history, despite that he was really wrongfully in prison, even white Americans were burning the flag then, stepping on the flag then, you know, because everybody was upset, Vietnam War, that kind of stuff. And he said, if you all won't pick it up, I will. He wasn't just talking to Muslims. He was talking to all of America. An imam, a Muslim imam, picked up the American flag and made those kind of comments. He said, we have an obligation to support, defend, and protect our society. And he didn't just pick it up and stand. He walked with it and let it flay, wave, old glory, what we call old glory. And then he stopped and it rested on him. My uncle was so excited. That excitement came back to me. Because when he picked that flag up and made those comments, he restored credit to the sacrifices that my uncle had made. So that excitement that he brought back to me, being my mentor, I was a teenager at that time. You know, teenagers think about what they're going to do when they grow up, right? So I had other things in mind, but because of that, I decided to go into the military. And that brought me here to Washington, D.C. This community followed my career, my 30 years, where I made a lot of things happen for Muslims.
How did you end up here? How did you become an imam?
When I came to the military, I joined as a Muslim, but I wasn't, before coming to the military, I wasn't really living as a Muslim. I was committed, but not necessarily a lot of the practice. When I came here, I began to practice a lot. I was in the military, and I wanted to be a Muslim. But it was in 1979, which is to tell you that it wasn't popular. They weren't really ready for a whole lot of Muslims in the military. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that to say that what led me here was this community, they were following me in our international newspaper. Because I pioneered a lot of things that weren't
Masjid
in place.
Muhammad,
this Masjid Muhammad right here. They were following me in that newspaper. And mm-hmm. the things that we pioneered were this. We had no Islamic chaplains.
In the military.
So I'm one of the ones that pioneered getting Islamic chaplains in our armed forces, period. In fact, the first one came in 1993, a good friend of mine. And now we have several in all branches of the service. And they didn't have accommodations in the military for things like 30 days of fasting, which is known as the month of Ramadan. That was tough. So we ended up getting, through pioneering that, now the military supports as much as possible. They accommodate that. In fact, there's a letter that comes out of the Pentagon every year now, before Ramadan, that says Ramadan's getting ready to come. Try to make accommodations for your soldiers, airmen, sailors, Marines, etc. during these times, you know. And being able to pray. Muslims pray five times a day. And generally, one or two of those prayers will come during a duty day in the military. And so at first I had to pray in closets because it just wasn't dedicated space, you know, where you can go. And eventually my supervisor let me use his office and other things in conference rooms. But eventually we began to get space, dedicated space on military bases. And not almost every military base now has space. And some very dedicated. I mean, they actually call some mosques on military bases. That's really something there. So we pioneered those things. They were following me. I began to be very scholarly, began to study, began to travel. And military actually sent me to school to learn Arabic. How mm-hmm. about that? How neat is that? I spent 30 years in the Air Force and did a lot of things. They always wanted me to be a chaplain because I worked with the chaplains from day one. I needed the chaplains. They became mm-hmm. my best friends because their chaplains are in the military to make sure just that, you know, is your freedom of religion.
So from the beginning, you were already involved in
I was involved
interfaith
so
efforts.
Much. Yeah. Exactly. But this community saw all of that. And when I retired from the Air Force, which was 6 years ago, the imam that was here, he retired the same month. So they thought it was a sign that they would bring me back here to lead this community. Islamic phobia hit too, so with my life having been on the line and partial to give it for our nation for 30 years, they thought it was important for me mm-hmm. to come back and be a demonstration of the loyalty and the sacrifices that Muslims have made and will continue to make.
You've been listening to Imam Talib M. Sharif. In a minute, he tells us about leading daily prayers and about the way his work changes during the month of Ramadan.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average, 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So can you tell us a little bit about what a typical day is like? Is there such a thing as a typical day?
Well, a typical day is really, everything is real fluent now. Well, the day really starts with prayer first thing in the morning, mm-hmm. The first prayer, which starts at 6:30 here.
Can you walk us through that first mm-hmm. 6:30 prayer? What are the steps? What do you go
this
through?
This is essentially what happens. Okay, we have someone would come to open up. Obviously, that's that time of morning. Someone has to come here and open the place up. And then they will be appointed to make the call to prayer. And we have speakers outside. And if you come around here in the morning, mm-hmm. you will hear that call.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allah.
The call to prayer is specific to Muslims, but it's not specific to faith communities because they all have a call, it's just different. Mm-hmm. Some have the bell, which we associate mainly with Christians. Some have the trumpet associated mainly with Jews, mm-hmm. but we have a human voice.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
What language is the call to prayer in?
The call to prayer is in the classical language, in Arabic. And of course, if they don't know what it's saying, it's really calling humanity to come together under the authority and under the guidance that's been approved by the Almighty, the Creator of the heavens and the earth. And you have to turn to the person that makes the call. And this is how your day is beginning to be focused. And for me, all of us have to focus. You turn to what's called the Qibla. And this is by that indication, the direction that everybody turns. So wherever Muslims are in the world, their direction is going to be, from here is northeast, which is it's the house that they're facing is in Mecca. It happens to be in Mecca. It's called the Kaaba. Kaaba means to make connections. It's a square house, a cube that was built by Abraham and his son, Ismail. And the root word for Qibla, this is a classical language now, is Qabalah, which means what came before. What came before what? What came before you? What came before me? Where did I come from? So it takes us back to the first. It takes us back to Adam, mm-hmm. our common origin. And he didn't have a racial identity, didn't have a national identity, didn't have an ethnic identity. So you always connect your life with all human life and don't separate yourself from all of humanity.
Allahu Akbar, Allah.
And so I'm here, we're listening, and I will read Quran while we're waiting. I will be sitting up here, and I may grab a book, or I may pull it up on my telephone. You know, you got the Quran, you can download them now, and I'm sitting there reading.
Reading silently or
reading out loud? Silently. I will make two extra units of prayer. You know, when we pray, Muslims, they have a series of movements from standing, and they ended up prostrating and then sitting. So I would do two voluntary units before the mandatory prayer, and then I wait. And then when everybody gets in, it's about that time that we say, then we give another call that says it's time for prayer now. We're ready to pray. Everybody line up. And when they get shoulder to shoulder, I go up front.
How many people are usually
and,
here?
And in the morning, morning is a smaller group because in the morning, it's maybe less than 20 mm-hmm. In the mornings. Unless it's the weekend, maybe a little more on the weekends. But obviously during the week, it's a little shorter because of traffic and everything and mm-hmm. in the distance. And then after that prayer, I will do a very short presentation, you know, something inspirational. When Muslims pray, the prayer that I'm speaking about, when we do the series of movements, we're actually reading the Holy Quran in a classical language. So some of them might not know what I said. I might speak about or educate on something that I read from the Quran. Very short, though, very short.
Just a few minutes?
Yeah, just a few, and just to get things moving. And then of course, people will disperse after that to try to get to work and everything, because, again, I'm already at work, unless I need to go back and prepare to, because I will come in the mornings, if I don't have a meeting right away, I will come a little more loose in terms of my dress. Mm-hmm. And if I have to have a meeting, then I may leave to go home. I won't bring that suit with me. I'll go back and change and everything and then go make some meetings. If it's a loose day, dress-down day, obviously, I stay, I go to the office, and I immediately start going through my inbox, mail that's been coming in, and I look at my telephone messages that I have in the mail, and then I obviously start responding to those things. And I look at my appointments, see what kind of appointments I have to begin to plan my day, okay? We just had a prayer, which was the third prayer of the day.
What time was that at?
And that took place around 2:30. And so the next prayer would take place close to 5. And so that takes time. So that's obviously clocked into every single day. I have to take time to make prayer. And you'll see several, like they got some small lines here now while we're here, but you'll see many lines lined up here when the actual prayer time comes in. These are people now, the period for prayer is still in, so they just missed the group prayer, so they're making that prayer now. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that happens. The other things that happen during the day is I'm greeting the senior citizens who are part of the program, engaging them, speaking with them. Playing, we have activities here. I may play cards with them. Mm-hmm. I may play checkers or chess with them as well. And I mean, then we sit down, we eat together, and just socially hear from them. You'll find that happening during the day from 10 to 2. Certainly, I have to meet with the staff. We have obviously a staff that works here. We have two executives here under myself, one dealing with the external, one dealing with internal. And we have to look at the calendar, look at what's going on. I have to hear reports from them. Today, I was on the phone. I had several phone calls where different leaders wanted to discuss what's happening right now.
Other Islamic leaders or with?
No,
with
not him? Just, no, these phone calls, most of them are not Islamic leaders. Mm-hmm. Most of them are other leaders from other faith, Christians and Jews and others, because we were part of a lot of different networks, and they're all concerned about what's going on. And so I returned those phone calls, and we kind of meeting. So that's happening during the day. And we certainly welcome that, because we're building coalitions of those who are concerned for the betterment of our society. And so we certainly welcome that. And we spend a lot of time engaging that and seeing what else can we do. And we're speaking about events that are going on. What are we going to do next? We have this, and we're planning for events. So that's a big part of what we're doing as well.
What time do you head home at night?
And the last prayer of the night will happen close to 7. And then, because we'll kind of try to shut things down at that time. Now, let me give you, if I can give you this story real quick. You see, we're in the community right here. So our neighbors, some of them hear this call. And we have churches across the street. One morning, one of the preachers rushed over here after the prayer. And he was upset. And, of course, we get complaints from time to time. Obviously, demographics change. People may not be here that long. They might not be familiar with the prayer anyway. Complain because they don't want to hear it at all. But he came. He said, "Y'all made me late for work." That particular day, the speakers were broke. And he was using that as his alarm clock.
Are there specific times in the year, holidays, Ramadan, for example, I imagine, when your schedule changes when you...
Yes. Certainly changes during the month of Ramadan, which is the 30 days of fasting.
Mm-hmm. How are your days different?
It's different during that time. We limit appointments because we want to read. In the month of Ramadan, which is the month that the Quran was revealed in history, mm-hmm. we try to read the whole Holy Quran during that month. So we'll start reading in the morning, and then we'll read it during the day. Obviously, when you're working, you got to do some things you got to do. You can't cancel all the appointments. But the days are longer because we do a special prayer at night. After that fifth prayer, there's another prayer where you do several units. And so we end up being here sometime to 10, 11 o'clock at night. So my schedule changes. I take more breaks during the day because I know from the morning to the night, they're going to be a little longer. And then we try to read that 30th of the Quran. It's in like 30 parts. So if you figure 30 days, then at 30 days, you would have read the whole Holy Quran.
You've been listening to Imam Talib M. Sharif. After this brief break, he talks about responding to Islamophobia and about the threat of Donald Trump.
What's the best way to learn a language? Immersion, living where the language is spoken and using it every day in everyday situations. But if that's not on the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. I've used apps in the past to learn new languages, but when I came across Babbel, I wondered if it could help me refresh my knowledge of a language I once spoke well, but was now a little bit or quite a lot rusty. I have to say, I was impressed. The advanced lessons were really useful, tips and idioms that can help with in-depth conversations on topics that I can actually imagine chatting about. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations, and the tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. What's more, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for working listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for working listeners, at babbel.com/working. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/working, spelled babbel.com/working. Rules and restrictions may apply.
You've talked a little bit about interfaith projects. What does that involve?
Yeah, they're diverse, and that's good because we have various relationships, and they're not all, they just come together and understand each other. They're not all like that. Some are like that, where we want to talk about how can we share where we are common, and then how can we share where we are different without resorting in a conflict. And then some of the groups are more specific in terms of what can we do? We need more affordable housing. How can we come together to put pressure on the city leadership for more affordable housing? This is what we call, this is the civic engagement piece of interfaith. Mm-hmm. And then we want to know, we got homeless people in the city. What can we do to help the homeless? And then we got veterans who are homeless. We have seniors who the taxes are getting real high. What can we do to help put pressure to give them some relief? So these are social things to try to bring about.
So a lot of that interfaith action isn't just about working for collective understanding, but working for the practical common
exactly,
good.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm the president of the Interfaith Conference. Now, it mainly started to understand each other. What do we have in common? You know, so it went from there to what can we do together now? Okay, we can come together and meet and talk together, but how can we begin to work together and share more? We just did an interfaith concert. We also do awards every year, but we find someone of one of the faiths that's been instrumental in helping those outside of his faith in the society. Mm-hmm. And we just did that recently. And of course, yes, we have to deal with terrorism and then stigmas that are attached to that, phobias, atrocities around the world, et cetera.
How do you respond to those stigmas, the belief that so many have that Islam is linked to terrorism? That must be a big part of what you have to do.
Let me give you this here. It really is consistent with what I did when I was in the military. Let me give you an example. I was in the military when 9/11 affected our life so tragically in the military, because they are just reflecting of society. So if we saw hate crimes and assaults and verbal attacks outside the military, then certainly we're going to see some of those things inside the military. A part of the mission that I was on was protecting soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines who were right on the front line. And we had many of the nationals that were of Arab descent. Some were Muslim, some weren't even Muslim, they were just Arab descent. But Arab was demonized, Muslim was demonized. And so some of the military people began to make disparaging comments, began to make them feel uncomfortable in the environment.
The people
that they were working with. We were all on the same team, you know, doing the same thing. But this is how significant it was. It affected them so much that their production began to go down. And this is why it's dangerous, even in our society, to accept that, to allow that, because that means that every citizen can't be healthy to make the nation, that country that they love, better, because they're not going to give their 100%. So that 100%, it went down. So the commander came to me. He asked me, he said, "Sharif, do something about this." They knew I was engaged, and I knew I was a Muslim, and I was educating. I was doing a lot of programs in the military. And so my mind said, "What you want me to do, sir?" You know. But what I decided to do was this, and this is what we do. I decided to do an education campaign. This was to educate them on what Muslims were doing, how they have been serving this country that we love for so long. And I put a list together of people. This was a military environment, so I wanted to make sure I had a strong impact. At the top of the list, and this gives you an idea how the rest of it went, at the top of the list, the commanding chief for our military was President Bush at the time. The doctor, his number one doctor, was a Muslim. A Muslim, and he just happened to be of immigrant descent, our commanding chief had given his life to this person to protect it, to service his life, you see. So this is what we do. We try to find out how can we best educate our population on who we are and how we all have made our society stronger, or how we can weaken it by not working together to make sure that we all are comfortable in the environment that we call home.
In the last year or more, though, Donald Trump's rhetoric against Muslims has really amped up and I think amplified the volume of some of that hatred, probably made it harder to ignore. How has that rhetoric affected the work that you do in your community and with other communities?
It affected my work, and I have to speak more. Certainly, we have to shape our sermons. Mm-hmm. Have to be shaped to help get the people more assurances, more faith, hope, because some just don't, they lose hope. So I have to be more engaged in that. I have to be more engaged in setting up panels to discuss it, educational panels. And we've done a lot of those, and we're going to do many, many more. I have more meetings now with so many different groups now that want to know what else can we do.
Are there ways that you are working to make sure that members of your community are safe?
Yes, we've done a lot of things. I'm really grateful that we work with MPD. We've actually had them come here,
the Metro Police Department,
FBI, the director of Bates, right here in D.C. He came here, did a town hall from right here. The U.S. attorney came here. So we create partnerships with them and to help debrief us on what we can do and how to respond and how they can help us. Because that's what everybody want to know. You know, we don't want them to fear them and not be able to respond. We want them to see us in partnership. Because when something's wrong, you thank police, you thank law enforcement, you know what I mean? Because we don't have the authority to do certain things. So it's important for us not to see them as enemies. And so we engage and we speak to them and we meet with them on a regular basis to get updates on things, on what we can and can't do. If we've seen something, we communicate it. Most of the arrests that they made have come from Muslims. That's a fact. And because of relationships. So those are the kind of things we're doing. We have the officer. We had to enhance our security here, cameras. You see the windows. Those are things that are recent in history, actually. You know, we had threats. We've had telephone threats. We've had letters, threats through mail, on email. I'm speaking somewhere. If it's a social piece, you got some people in the trail. They say things that are threatening.
What's it like to get a threat like that? How do you feel when something like that shows up in your inbox
it's hurtful. You know, I'm a citizen, just like that person that's speaking as a citizen. We're in this together. This is our country. It's not his. It's not mine. It's ours. And I know they don't know. They can't know me. You know, they can't know this community. They can't know the history. And most of them are just ignorant, and that's what we're finding. I mean, I've served this nation. And I'm just one of many. And that was just the field where you have to put your whole life on the line for the whole country. And they obviously don't know that. To make the kind of comments, and then they say to go home, this is home. What are you talking about? You know, most of the people who are here, they're second, third, fourth generation now. This is home now. There's no other home. What are you talking about? We don't want nobody to tear this down because this is where we live. So it's hurtful to hear people, and we know it's going to weaken us because we're stronger together. You know, diversity is what makes us strong. They say we our motto is united we stand, divided we're falling. And that's what's happening. We're falling.
When someone, a young person especially, say, comes to you and says, I'm afraid that we are falling, what do you say to them?
Well, I say several things. First thing, I have to remind them that we say all day long, Allahu Akbar, okay? And that means God is bigger. He is greater. He's more important. And nothing is out of his scope. And whatever we are going through, it's not permanent. It's temporary, you see? And there's always going to be more good, even though it looks like it now. And that's true. We have to have faith. We are faith people. So I have to respond to them and give them this faith. The evil that we're seeing, this harm, this hatefulness, is because they band together and the good is spread out. But when we come together, we can reduce it. I give them these pictures of hope and let them know how there are many working for good.
Are there ways that non-Muslims can help support you and members of your community?
Yes, yes. There are definitely ways that non-Muslims can support us. See us as neighbors. See us just like anybody else, that grocery store. We may be serving them their food at a restaurant. You may be bringing their mail. Maybe that police officer that respond. Maybe that person on the front line that just gave his life that you didn't even know. Everybody not announcing that they're Muslim. Understand that and stand up for the life that stands up for you early in this year. And this is what happened here. We were threatened to be attacked. This mosque right here was threatened by a group in America called the Global Something for Humanity. And they had selected around 20 plus mosques and Islamic centers to do an armed protest across America. We were on their list. And they had us picked to come at a certain time. I was leading a delegation in Turkey. My community was wanting me to give them some instructions on how to handle this because we were getting a lot of calls from religious leaders because we got great partnerships. And they wanted to come over here and say, we'll be there and stand with you. We'll make sure that they don't even come near you, this and that. And that my instructions were this. Don't do anything. I don't want us to give any attention to them. If we do anything, then we're going to be asked by the media about what we're doing, and then we have to highlight them. I don't want to do that. See, just stay normal, be vigilant, be aware, but be vigilant. But this is what happened, and this is what we want to happen, and we don't want to have to be defending ourselves. This is an example of what should be happening. The neighbors, without us knowing about it, they had gotten together, and they made signs up. And they posted signs. They came and posted signs on the trees, on the poles right out in front of the masjid in the neighborhood, so that they can be clearly seen, that said, this is a hate-free zone. We stand with Masjid Muhammad, our neighbors. Now, my team here say they saw two carloads that fit the description.
Fit the description
of the group that was supposed to do the hate group. But they didn't stop. We suspect that it was that group. But we know they saw those signs because they were very visible. And we didn't have to do anything to defend ourselves. But I just found out recently, one of the major newspapers in the city followed up on that, and they wanted to talk to the person that led that campaign, and they found that person. And these are not Muslims.
The anti-hate campaign,
which was not a Muslim. None of them were Muslims. But again, we live in this community. We're their neighbors. They told this newspaper that if they had to, if that group had stopped or got out or had come to protest against us, that they had all of them had agreed to form a human chain between us and them. So they wouldn't even get near us.
Thank you, Imam, so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, I appreciate the honor of having you visit us, and certainly appreciate it. Your time is appreciated as well as my time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the podcast. Our email address is working@slate.com. You can listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. Working is produced and edited by Mickey Kapper. Thank you to Ayman Ishmael, who helped us bring this episode together. Thanks to Afim Shapiro as well. Our executive producer is Steve Lichtai, and the chief content officer of the Panoply Network is Andy Bowers.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.